Group meeting, Saturday, 11th April, 1987. Last time, we started Chapter 6, entitled The Divine Dialogue. And we came to the point where we mentioned how in several of the Upanishads, a short question is asked, the answer to which is put into the mouth of one or other of the three persons of the Trinity. And I gave various examples. In the Maitreya Upanishad, Maitreya, the disciple, is answered by Mahadeva. Mahadeva is one of the names of Shiva, the third person. In the Kaivalya, Ashvalayana is answered by Brahma, the creator. In the Atma Bodha, the teaching is given by Narayana, which is the name for the Supreme Being. In the Subhala, again by Brahma. Now, how shall we understand these and many similar examples? You know how in the New Testament, Old Testament for instance, then the angel of the Lord spoke unto such and such a prophet, etc., etc. Throughout the religions there is this mention of the divine dialogue, the dialogue between the Holy One and the Supreme, whatever that Supreme may be. Various are the approaches to the Supreme Communion in silent aloneness. This divine dialogue is only one way, and it was a very useful and convenient way of talking about that which is realized by the perfected Holy One in the state of supreme communion, or if you like to put it another way, in the state of the profoundest consciousness that human beings are capable of. And this supreme communion always takes place in silent aloneness, because we members of the human species are still separate individual beings. So there is an aloneness to be realized by ourselves, for one thing, and then the communion with the totality, with transcendence, can only take place in silence, because how is any human being to talk, which language shall he use, talking with the Supreme Being or with the One Total Reality? Because in that silence, one's innermost consciousness is fully awake. Our consciousness is awake only in this worldly way, in terms of the finite, the particular, and the temporal. It is the mortal way. In the innermost depths of consciousness, there is that capacity to function in terms of the infinite, the eternal, and therefore the immortal. And in that state, there is neither thought nor speech. They are completely absent. You are awake, the body is awake, and you yourself are aware that you are in that state. I think the Kabbalists and the Hebrews called it the I am state. You see? In the Upanishads too, you get the statement that the supreme condition is the Ahang. Ahang. I am. You see? And the Upanishadic sages always said, Ahang Brahmasmi, which split up into the three words, is Ahang Brahma Asmi. Ahang I, Brahma Am. Asmi is Am. You see, it's directly related to the Latin language. Latin is related to Sanskrit. You have sum, as, est, asmi, asti, asti, you see, is the equivalent of the Latin est. Now, so that supreme communion always takes place in silent aloneness. Each one of us, all people in the world, in fact, can, perhaps do, experience that silent aloneness as and when they are really in the profoundest possible slumber. Because in the deepest sleep, there is no disturbance taking place in the brain in connection with worldly matters. Our dreams and so on are all connected with worldly things, and they are all connected with oneself, the separate self. I. Look at your dreams. Consider your dreams. I saw this, I did that, etc., etc. It all revolves around the isolative, separative consciousness. I, the separate self. You see? But in the profound slumber, the brain is at last asleep. And in that sleep, consciousness, the innermost consciousness, which is part and parcel of your integral being, is awake. And it experiences, and it can experience, and it does experience, the supreme reality, the total reality. But of course, when the body awakes again, that consciousness doesn't come through. But the effect it has had is particularly to refresh and rejuvenate the whole psychophysical organism. That is why when you have really enjoyed a good sleep, then you wake up refreshed, you feel energetic and strong and so on, you see. But mind you, as age comes on, it is different. I don't feel anything like so tremendously refreshed and energetic when I wake up each day now. One is born, one lives, and there is a departing, and the departing can be slow. And sometimes the departing is attended with a great deal of swinging on the gate. You see? But some of the deep realizations can take place just when you're swinging on the gate. So that's not to be despised. Now, when the heart grows still with the touch of beauty, when self so surrenders that passion meets love as the river meets the sea, when the mind is so free of all images that truth shines shadowless, or when the votive act flows into the heart of infinite grace, there are no gates to bar the way to that supreme communion. The heart grows still with the touch of beauty. Transcendence is perfect beauty, indescribable. There are no criteria for judging the beauty of transcendence. But transcendence is the perfect beauty. But that beauty, the shadow of that beauty, the picture, if you like, of that beauty, and the picture is not the living person, remember, is in existence, which is transcendence, which has put itself out into manifestation. That is why there is beauty throughout the universe. Otherwise there wouldn't be, or may not be. Our ideas of beauty are all conditioned ideas. A beautiful face is like this, like that, and the other. A beautiful picture is like this, and a beautiful piece of music or poetry or a house or whatever it is, like this, that, and the other. We lay down conditions according to the manner in which our own brain has been conditioned from birth onwards. But where transcendence is concerned, there is the absolute beauty. So the heart grows still with the touch of beauty. When self so surrenders that passion meets love as the river meets the sea. Passion here is not passion in the common garden sense of the word, whether it be a passion to do this or that or the other, or a sexual passion or whatever it is. It has nothing to do with that. Passion is fundamentally, in its innermost being, a suffering. The Latin word passio, it means I suffer. We talk of the passion of Christ when we are talking about the suffering of Christ on the cross, or even actually before the cross. And I say before the cross too, because the perfected holy ones know that kind of passion, which is suffering with the suffering of all humanity, of all existence. They say that Christ died on the cross. Now, it's not so much a case of dying on the cross as representing the death of the cross. Because what does the cross signify? The vertical line and the horizontal line, which makes the symbol of the cross. The horizontal line represents matter, and the vertical line represents spirit. And the cross, one of its meanings anyway, is the imprisonment of spirit in matter. And when we die in the true sense of death, that is, we are completely transformed, salved. We have found our salvation. Spirit is released out of matter into its own reality. And at the same time, and I don't think this has been written before, as far as I know, at the same time as spirit is released out of its imprisonment in matter, it transmutes matter back into spirit. Because where does matter come from? But from transcendence. You see? It's like that. So, when passion meets love, and then only love in its transcendent reality is actually manifest, actually experienced by and through the perfected Holy One. As the river meets the sea, when the mind is free of all images, that truth shines shadowless. Why doesn't the mind cotton on to truth immediately, here and now, as we are? Because it is so conditioned. And its conditioning takes the shape of so many different images, thoughts, ideas, beliefs, convictions, and all the rest of the claptrap, which we think is knowledge and so forth and so forth. You see. But it isn't. So when the mind, the psyche actually, I should say, is free of all these images, the images may remain there as memory, but if you yourself have really seen into them and understood that these are but images, then you are free of the domination of those images. And therefore, you see truth. That is, you don't see any shape. Truth is shapeless and formless. It cannot be conceptualized, it cannot be spoken about. The truth, the actuality, the transcendent actuality, is something which absolutely is. And in innermost consciousness, when you have realized yourself as the perfected Holy One, you are conscious in that way. You are the truth. That is why the great teachers, Jesus, Sri Krishna, so many teachers said, I am the truth. And that is the meaning of it. At least so it seems to me. So truth shines shadowless. Oh, when the votive act, the act of devoted self-surrender, flows into the heart of infinite grace, there are no gates to bar the way to Supreme Communion. Before the complete emergence into the silence, to emerge means to go into, remember, there is a state of discriminative consciousness characteristic of the Holy One's approach on each separate occasion. You may recall, I have spoken quite a bit in recent months about the uniqueness of the individual. See, transcendence manifests itself in terms of countless variety. No two things are the same. No two blades of grass or two leaves on a tree are the same. And certainly no two human beings are the same. And this is one of the great beauties of transcendence. It's infinite, unending variety. And so it is our duty as individuals to discover that uniqueness in ourselves. And therefore, the way in which we approach transcendence will be our own way. That is why I say again and again, no one can lay down the way for you. If you care, if you really are serious about it, then you will find your way. And that way won't come to you in terms of particular commandments or thoughts or ideas or plans. It will just happen. You have to let it happen. We do nothing. Transcendence does everything. I am not the doer. This is one of the great illusions that has bedeviled mankind through the ages. I am the doer. I am going to do this. I am going to do that. And what he does is generally makes a fool of himself if he is least evil, And if he is most evil, then he does the evil things we all know about and hear about, right in our own day and age. So, that is a state of discriminative consciousness, one's own consciousness, which is the sort of intermediate state, almost a final intermediate state before realizing the Supreme Communion. And the way and the nature of that communion will be your way. It won't be the same as anybody else's way. You see? When Jesus gave the commandment, that was the one and only commandment he ever gave, which was his own, before the crucifixion. He said, "This one commandment I give unto you, love ye one another as I have loved you." But the I there is not Jesus, the son of Joseph and Mary. The I there is transcendence itself. It is the Ehyeh of the Ehyeh, Asher Ehyeh of Exodus chapter 3 verse 14. I am that I am, the one and only supreme I am. And when that happens, it is not I who am that I am, but that I am is embodied and fully manifest in this organism, which will die. But that other will never die, of course. So there is this discriminative consciousness, which is your own consciousness, the consciousness which is able to say I, which is able to analyze, to perceive otherness, separateness, and so forth. Now, this last consciousness, state of personal consciousness, discriminative, vijnana, as the Buddhists put it, it influences the form or nature of the consciousness which will emerge after the silence. You are in one state now. When you experience that silence, when you experience the Supreme Communion, that is to say, the Supreme Communion is experienced by transcendence through your organism. Do realize that. If you can realize that, you will transform your life and you will help to transform the lives of those around you. Not I, but it. Transcendence is the absolute all, the everything. You see, which manifests through us. We have the power to hinder it. And we have it in us to have the good sense, the decency, and the true humanness to cooperate with it, to serve it. That's what human beings can't do. That is why, that may be why, I won't say that is, but that may be why some people stick to rituals and this and that and the other. They say their prayers, they do this, they do the other, and they feel, I'm a good chap. God has heard me. God does not hear me. God hears himself only. Do realize that. So, communion influences the form or nature of the consciousness which will emerge after the silence. The silence itself is devoid of both discriminative consciousness and unconsciousness. You know, our great scholars and even our greatest psychologists of today, they still make awful mistakes where this is concerned. They use the word trance. Trance is a hopelessly inadequate and misleading word with respect to the state of the Supreme Communion. It is a transcendent state, yes. Transcendent. What transcends is that which is beyond our ordinary ken. See, that is what is transcendent, beyond our present knowledge. And it has, and this communion state has nothing to do with being in a trance. And it is not, and they also use the word ecstasy in relation to it, which is an error, a real error. Ecstasy means being beside yourself, you see. But these communion happens in enstasy. It is the going within yourself to such an extent that the so-called separate self, the point, vanishes as a point and becomes the total, the totality of all existence. These things are quite different from what so many scholars, right up to our present times, and even the greatest of the psychologists say, they just haven't got it properly. That's what I say. Don't believe a word of what I say. You find out. For here, in this state, awareness and being are identical. It is not a case of I, a being, am aware of that. But the supreme awareness, the supreme consciousness and being are one and the same reality, one and the same thing. That is another way of understanding, I am the truth, the way, the life. Sri Krishna said it, Zarathustra pointed it out. Jesus said it, and so on. As the emergence, the coming out of, emergence is going into, emergence is coming out of, as the emergence out of the silence proceeds, that awareness being suffers limitation into form. A form distinguished by attributes traditionally associated with one or other of the divine names, which are the springs of power and benediction in the scriptures of the world. You know, for instance, in Zarathustrianism, I think also in Islam, there are 101 names for God, you see. But these names, they have specific meanings, dictionary meanings. They represent the different sort of spiritual powers which can work then. And they affect our own psyche in such a way as to produce the particular type of conceptualizing and verbalizing which we do produce afterwards. Now, this mode of consciousness is the fount of inspired teachings which the Holy One presents in the shape of the divine dialogue. So he says, and the angel of the Lord said unto me, or whatever it is, you see, something like that. And the saying is different from another prophet's saying. And often from his own previous saying, and will be different now from what he will say next time the thing happens. You know, Krishnamurti is an interesting case of this sort of thing. If you read his notebook carefully, and his journal and so forth, you will see the hints there. Every sentence of this prophetic speech is the milk of deep prayer and the bread of contemplation for his disciple. the named divinities are products of man's mind, temporal and unreal, labels, so to say, of the immortal real. You know, I have, in my long life, it is a long life now, come across, because I've been to the meetings of different societies, people who were rather keen upon impressing upon those present the fact that they had an experience, you see. So, of course, this chap's status goes up. He's the fellow who has had an experience. If only it were an experience of falling down the stairs, then it would certainly be truth, which he said. But this experience, which gives him some sort of spiritual authority, is usually nonsensical. I've heard a man say in open meeting, and it was a conference in the 1950s, this happened in Brighton. He said, "God has spoken to me, you see, and I know what He wants." God wants. If you say God, the word want can never be associated with the word God. If you say God speaks, Dutch, German, Chinese, Japanese, or twaddle. You see, the extraordinary stupidity to which man can descend with his illusion about himself. Yes, they are temporal. Sometimes what he says is most worthwhile. We have it actually in the writings of the mystics and so forth. But what he says is only a label. It's only a photograph, but not the living reality. You can use the words just as you can use my words or what you read or anybody's words in your particular way. If you have the power if you have the insight which can see, penetrate into the actuality, the living reality underlying the word, then you will benefit. But the other fellow who said it to you, intending to benefit you, was wasting his breath. Merely to read the letter of the scriptures easily misleads the reader into regarding the named divinities as independent personal beings, other than him who is in communion. This is the great mistake which particularly has affected the theistic religions. The named God, the described God. God is this, that and the other. I don't know, no one knows what God is. Because that is transcendent. It is beyond one's ken. But you can get glimmerings, you can get glimpses, and you can see more and more deeply here and now the manifestation of the transcendent. But remember, it's the manifestation, it's the photograph. It is not the actuality. If he who reads has known a loosening of the bonds, better still, the dissolution of the limitations imposed by separative self-consciousness, he will be free of the confusion-making conflict between the I and the thou. Thou and I. There is no such thing in actuality as thou and I. There is only the one total reality. We, being conscious in our limited ways and through the use of our sense organs and the interpretation by the brain, are unable to escape this limitation of seeing everybody as somebody other than oneself, of every object as something other than oneself, and so forth. But in the Supreme Consciousness, as far as man is concerned, it's the holistic consciousness. There is no separation. There is no otherness. You actually experience being that which the senses convey to you, being the so-called other person, the other object. Practice it. Use your eyes when you look, and just look. And as you look, observe what the brain is doing, how it is talking away, 100 to the dozen. Oh, that's a tall tree, that's an oak tree. It's marvelous in this, that and the other. Last year I saw it, it was like this, that. Your brain is doing that all the time. That prevents you from communion with the tree. Just look and try and let the chatter of the brain completely cease, and then you will find that you have become the tree. This is not magic, this is not absurdity. This is simple fact. Then he will not mistake the named divinity as a transcendent being wholly other than the self-conscious I. Then too he will become aware, provided his thought processes do not interfere, of the living meaning hidden in the words of Scripture. I am that I am. You know how people say it, I am that I am. That is the wrong way to say it. It's Exodus chapter 3 verse 14, when the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, speaks to Moses out of the burning bush. He says, Ehye, Asher Ehye. Moses asks, what shall I say to the Israelites when they ask me, who has sent you to deliver us? And the Lord God says, say unto them, Ehye, Asher Ehye. I am that I am, the one and only total absolute reality. Yahweh Elohim. Of course, they put it in the personal God form. But it's perfectly true. That is how it is. Or when the Upanishadic sage said, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. The Buddha said, the Tathagata, that is himself, is a name tantamount to truth, Dhamma. He was the truth, tantamount to Brahman, the absolute all. And again, the Tathagata, that is Gautama Buddha, is the Dhamma become. He has become the truth. He is the Brahma become. He has become Brahman. And Jesus said, I am the truth, the way, and the life. And my brain. The famous Sufi mystic who was cruelly crucified, he said, An al-Haq, I am the truth. Somebody buy me a new brain. The Supreme Communion is not the communion of an I with a separate thou. In the Supreme Communion, there is a vanishing of the opaque barrier of separative self-consciousness. Phenomenally, the separate psychophysical organism which bears the teacher's name is there, a tangible, living man visible to all. But with the vanishing of self-consciousness, separative self-consciousness, he who erstwhile was conscious as I am myself and not you, is no longer conscious in these terms, nor in the terms thou and I are one. He is in the state of I am, asmi, aham. The one and only I am, which is the one total absolute reality. He does not know in the ordinary sense of a perceiving subject knowing the observed object that he is in the I am state. In that final state, he doesn't know that he is in that state. When the I am shines unobstructedly through him, it's only when he comes out of it, the actual experiencing has made such an impress on the organism that the brain often is able to produce the memory of it, and it clothes it in concept. And whatever is clothed in a concept also has its corresponding word, its corresponding speech. Thus, the Supreme Communion is in actual fact the disappearance of all that dismembers the unity. There is no separative consciousness of discrete particulars to sunder the unity of the I am. Here the word I is not a personal pronoun, nor does it represent a blown up self become super self by union with a God born of man's imagination. In this communion, where selfness is not, the word I may be spoken of as transpersonal. As Shiva said to Kumara the Kartikeya, it comes in the Tejubindu Upanishad, I am the I which has given up I. I am the I which has given up.